Oh, you know, I know all the narratives about Chernobyl. I know about it as a regular citizen of Ukraine, but I know very little, you know, as a in terms of some professional expertise. But I guess my first question that I want to ask is more personal. You know, right now the whole world is watching Ukraine, this war, and there were so many news and reports about Russian troops entering and capturing Chernobyl station, and then Energodar and Zaporizhia. So how did you feel about that? How did you react that apparently, you know, the things that you study and talk about, they become so significant today, so relevant, and, you know, and with all this horrible attacks on nuclear plants. So how did you feel? What do you think about what is happening?
You want to answer that, William?
Well, maybe you go first, I go second.
I'm very alarmed. I've studied this topic of nuclear history as a part of history, but to see it suddenly come to life and play out across live streamed on TV screens is a kind of an awful experience to have. Right, you know, the first day of the war, the Russian forces took the Chernobyl zone and the Chernobyl station without a fight. The station guard, put up a white flag because they understood that if missiles and heavy artillery started to fly around the station, there could be a much larger catastrophe. That shift stayed on the job without proper food or bedding or contact with their family members, under great psychological stress for 3 weeks. That's no way to run any kind of nuclear installation with hungry, tired, and stressed out workers who are supervised by soldiers and officers from the Russian army who don't necessarily know the first thing about that plant. The Russians have also apparently mined the perimeter of the Chernobyl zone and are basically using it as a safe haven to stockpile weapons and soldiers and convoys, knowing or figuring that the Ukrainian army will not send missiles flying at either the Zaporizhia plant or at the Chernobyl plant. So we're learning a new feature of war. This is the real first large-scale war in a nuclearized country. 54% of nuclear power before the war in Ukraine was generated by nuclear power. That's a big percent. That's, you know, a really nuclearized country. And I went through the manuals of the International Atomic Energy Agency and the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Agency looking for disastrous scenarios that included conventional warfare. Like what is more banal and inevitable than warfare in human history? But unbelievably, that none of these plants have been stress tested for being hit by a missile, by heavy artillery or battery. That just did not figure into the calculations for 50 years of planning for nuclear disasters. They thought about an errant plane landing on a nuclear power plant, but not something I think would be far more likely, like a missile. So we're basically in hot water right now. We don't have a playbook. And that's what happened, you know, that on February 24th, when the Russians took over the plant, the head of the shift called his boss in Slavutich, and he said, you know, we don't have anything in the manuals. We don't have any protocol for the arrival of an attacking army. And I think that tells us a lot about the overly optimistic attitude that nuclear regulators have had towards nuclear disaster.
Mm-hmm. I was born in 1986. I considered to be, my mother considered us to be lucky because we lived in Lviv, and Lviv was relatively safe, but as we know from history of nuclear catastrophes, and as we learn from today's experience, there is no really safe places. These places are only relatively safe, and relatively safe places can be very unsafe too. I've I remembered Volodymyr Shcherbytsky a number of times within the last months. And for Ukraine, in the Ukrainian memory, his public statements in the immediate aftermath of 1986 catastrophe are something very symbolic and something that left a long-term imprint on our collective memory. And back in 86, Shcherbytsky's line was, "Don't panic, everything is okay. There's no big damage, nothing really big happened." And then very soon the society and individual members learned this was not true. And at that point, it was already too late for many people. And the health was damaged inevitably for thousands of Ukrainians. And I am a little bit scared of this approach being repeated nowadays. I think that before the 24th of February, not related to nuclear accidents, but we've heard a lot on the TV that everything's under control, everything's fine, there's no need to panic. But in fact, Ukrainian people could have prepared better. And maybe they are not so stupid. They could really get ready without falling into this biggest panic and without failing economy. So I'm really afraid of this moment when the people are considered not smart enough to deal with the immediate danger. And within the last weeks, I've seen some cases which seemed very uncomfortable and very scary. For example, Ukrainian workers at the nuclear power Chernobyl nuclear power plant alarmed about a big danger of cutting the station from the electricity supply, but international agencies responded saying that there is no big danger. And these cases were numerous, and I think that this is particularly scary to not be alarmist. I think that we in this situation we should all be alarmist. We should not say nothing bad is happening, and we have to get ready to the worst. I have a Geiger counter at home at my flat, in my flat at Obolon. This is an old Geiger counter that belonged to Kate Brown, but it was not did not have an electronic tableau. So Kate Brown bought herself a new one and left me the old one. I'm really thinking about this, and I think that it's been maybe seven times that I thought, whom do I call in Kiev? Whom do I ask to get the key from my flat, go in and get the Geiger counter? Because there is no safe place, and the radiation is spotty. And even if the official radiation levels in your area are not too high, they may be too high in your particular square meter where you're standing. And I think that in this case, we should be alarmist, and we can use history to warn us.
Absolutely, yeah. And I want to say that I also was born and spent almost all my life on a balloon. So it's a pleasure to meet someone from my neighborhood, even under these circumstances. You mentioned different strategies, how political elites framed what was happening during the Chernobyl catastrophe, maybe trying to play down certain threats. And he also said that it seems that there are also international actors who, and both Ukrainian and international actors, can also use this kind of strategies right now. But can you elaborate on this story? Because as far as I understand, this is a big part of your book. Yeah, you studied these narratives and how different actors spin the story, trying maybe to sell different versions of what was happening. I understand this is a very broad question, but maybe you can just, you know, break it down and tell us what kind of actors were playing significant role, what are the conflicting narratives, whether, so what was the dynamic there?
Yeah, well, Olya and myself and a Belarusian researcher, Katya Krivichina-Nina, who's now a refugee in Poland from Belarusian fascism, we all worked together, and we worked through 27 archives to write this book. And you know, diving immediately into the Ministry of Health and Ministry of Agriculture archives in Kiev, it became very obvious that there was a, you know, a public health disaster that began the summer after the accident, when not 600 people were hospitalized, but our count is 44,000 people were hospitalized for Chernobyl injuries in just the summer after the accident, 11,000 of whom were kids. And, you know, and then, you know, how does this happen? Olya and I go to a wool factory in Chernihiv, and there are these women who are designated liquidators because they're handling many times a day big bundles of wool that, you know, are very radioactive. It's like hugging an X-ray machine all day long. And on and on and on, we find people like this. And so my question was, why don't we know this story? You know, why do we think only 36 people died from Chernobyl and 600 people were hospitalized, when it's so clear that that's not the case? So I worked my way through 5 UN archives. And what I found was a big battle going on between World Health and the International Atomic Energy Agency over who would be the one to make pronouncements on Chernobyl and health. And the World Health people said, we're the health people. And the International Atomic Energy Agency said, well, we're the nuclear people. And the agency was more powerful. They had more money. They had a higher standing in the UN family of nations. And so they managed to push the World Health Organization aside and make statements in the name of the entire UN about the assessment of damage of health for the Chernobyl aftermath, the Chernobyl fallout. And that's really interesting. Olya was just pointing out that the IEA was saying there's no problem with not providing electricity to the Chernobyl station. There are basins there of spent fuel. They can self-heat, and they need to be cooled with pumps and cool water. And if they are exposed, if that water evaporates, if they're exposed, there could be an explosion. The IEA is saying that's, you know, that's a very slim chance. But what we have on the IEA right now is Russians have a preferential status on the board of governors, and they have not been kicked out. You know, there have been no sanctions within the IEA against Russia. And so they're still there. So when we see statements from the IEA, we see statements that are coming that are highly inflected by the Russian perspective. And that was the case during the Chernobyl time and the aftermath. And in fact, there were other parties that were also interested in minimizing the Chernobyl, the assessments of Chernobyl health problems. And that was the US government, the British government, and the French government, because they were all were nuclear powers. And after 1991, the Cold War archives were largely declassified, especially in Britain and the United States. And all kinds of people were finding out that they had been exposed from the testing and production of nuclear weapons, which dwarf by 4 orders of magnitude the radiation spent in the Chernobyl accident. And so people were coming forward and suing their governments. But if you could say, look, here's the world's worst nuclear accident, Chernobyl, and only 33 people died, then those lawsuits could go away. And that's indeed what happened. And so that's the kind of sort of, you know, I guess if we're going to call this, you know, panel nuclear colonialism, those are the kind of, Ukraine was the kind of, you know, colonial nuclear space where those kinds of scenarios could play out quite easily, especially in the collapsing political and economic situation of the 1990s. Now, Olya found all this material about cases of nuclear accidents and deliberate nuclear detonations in Ukraine before Chernobyl. That it talks about how much the officials in Moscow were interested in making tests and experiments, but not doing it in Russia. Do you want to say something about that, Olya?
Well, except for the fact that there were a lot of nuclear experiments done in Russia too. really.
Yeah, but you know, like Siberia, right. Kazakhstan, the polar north, not right outside of Moscow.
So not only Ukraine was a kind of testing site. Maybe Ukraine was even less of a testing site than Asian territories of the Soviet Union, but we can definitely see a trend in these documents and in these files, and it's a kind of a trend of decisions, final decisions made in Moscow. And for example, 1969, 1970, there were some accidents in Kiev in the research institute, nuclear research institute. There was contamination of air and sewage water, and the extent of the contamination was not clear back in 1969, 1917. And then the Ukrainian Ministry of Health, and namely the sanitary agency, ordered that in response to these accidents, the institute should install a good counting equipment all around the research facility, and monitor air and sewage waters on a regular basis, as it is done nowadays. But the institute could not fulfill that requirement for a while because there was no equipment ready for, no good equipment produced in the Soviet Union. And the institute could not run its research work. And after half a year or a year, the institute asked to still keep working because the institute should fulfill the state plan of research, and particularly military research. So the institute was organized to serve some military defensive needs of the state, and the safety in the Soviet Union, as well as demands of the Ukrainian ministries, were secondary to that aim. There are also other examples. Volodymyr Shcherbinsky, for example, asked the state, the Soviet central authorities, to not install the Rivne nuclear power plant in the place where it is now. And they were cautious of the geological conditions in that location, but his plea was not taken seriously. And that these documents that are available. And later, already Shcherbinsky's milieu showed that he was actually trying to do something to ensure more safety, nuclear safety within the Soviet Union. And there are other stories, for example, the 1972 accident in Kharkiv Oblast. Kharkiv, there was a gas pipe. There was a big fire on the gas pipe, and there was a decision to put the fire down using the nuclear bomb. Basically, they make a big explosion in the gas, in the burning gas pipe, and it was unsuccessful. The result was unsuccessful, but the interesting thing is that all decisions were made in Moscow. And the local government, the Ukrainian government, hardly knew that they would have that the nuclear that this was a nuclear explosion. And people living around were just resettled for one day, and after one day they were brought back to their homes. No one knew this was nuclear explosion, and no measurements were taken, and no monitoring of health issues were taken. And this is not just one story. Also in Belarus and in other parts of Ukraine, these stories were similar. So we can actually make a statement that nuclear decisions were made in Moscow, and not always Ukraine was even informed about them. And the safety was secondary to the task of growing military power of the Soviet Union.
And you know, just to, I mean, that was what, 24 kilometers from Kharkiv? So a nuclear bomb was detonated very close to the city of Kharkiv by Russian scientists who were trying to see, like, will a nuclear bomb put out a fire in a gas well? I mean, it was a crazy experiment, and it went terribly wrong and sent up a big plume of a radioactive explosion from that gas hole, and the fire kept going. It didn't put out the fire.
Well, that's
known as Khrestysche accident. So if you have interest towards more accidents, you can just Google Khrestysche accident. You can also Google the nuclear accident in Kramatorsk, the mine in Yanakiyevo. It was another similar story. And you can also Google Tragedia of Mer in Polygon in Belarus, and you will find certainly some stories about nuclear experiments before 1986 in Ukraine and Belarus.
Well, this is fascinating. I am Googling it right now. The thing is that I knew very little about that. It's not a part of larger conversation in Ukraine. I think everyone knows about Chernobyl, but it's definitely not a part of common knowledge what you just described, and this is a very important piece of information, of course, and it's a fascinating story on some level. But also, I was quite intrigued with this perspective, because basically, and as Kate said, you mentioned the word imperialism here, yeah. So Ukraine was a kind of testing ground for for what Soviet and Russians were doing here, but also you described this story how international organizations tried to play down the level of threats, which I also find shocking and also surprising. This is definitely something that not a lot of Ukrainians know about. Usually we pursue this narrative of Soviet authoritarian regime that tried to, you know, to hide what was happening, which eventually also incentivized Ukrainian dissidents and other citizens, you know, to rebel against the regime and delegitimized the regime. So I wonder whether these issues of legitimacy also happened with international organizations. Yeah, so obviously people in Ukraine or other countries, they knew that Chernobyl was very bad, they blamed the government, they wanted to rebel against it. But what was the perception of public or other actors towards those organizations which you just mentioned, or there was no public reaction at all?
It was a big debate, I think, among people who cared about such things internationally. There was already among what we would call like sort of an anti-nuclear activist, there was already a lot of suspicion about the International Atomic Energy Agency and the statements that they made. And there was something already a term, well-established called the nuclear lobby, you know, people who were paid to promote a version that, you know, of that nuclear power is perfectly safe. And I mean, we still have that kind of nuclear lobby. The International Atomic Energy Agency was created by the United States in the 1960s because some independent scientists in Denmark and Scandinavia started questioning the impact of global fallout worldwide. They said, you know, we're finding radioactivity in mother's milk in Sweden. What's that about? And the US wanted to head off that move. And so they created this, we'll create an independent body within the UN, but rather than having scientists appoint scientists for that body, political leaders appointed, you know, political scientists, scientific diplomats to these positions. And they, you know, as we saw working through the archives, you know, they take the IEA serves services its client states. Its biggest client states are are the ones that get preferential treatment, or the nuclear powers. So we found these, you know, consultants for the IAEA doing things like, you know, a Ukrainian doctor says, we know we have all these problems with kids with thyroid cancer. You know, it says this right away, 1989. And they say, that's impossible. You know, we don't expect that kind of effect. And it certainly wouldn't happen this soon. So the Ukrainian doctor says, well, you know, why don't you take these biopsies and you take them home and check them? There's 20 kids here. That would indicate an epidemic. The background rate at the time was 1 in 1 million children. And this is an area of about 200,000 children in this northern Ukraine. So 20 kids would indicate that that was an unbelievable number. This guy, Fred Mettler, he's an American. He brought those biopsies home to his lab in New Mexico. They all tested, you know, positive. They were, in fact, thyroid cancer. And what did he do with that information? He buried it. He didn't mention it in his report. He said that there were rumors of childhood pediatric thyroid cancer, but they were anecdotal in nature. When I called him up and said, hey, you know, what about this, these biopsies you took? And he goes, oh yeah, I guess I forgot about that. Just not 30 years later, but a few months after he got the biopsies, he wrote his report. So we find case after, they're trying to fire scientists who say, hey, there's real problems in Ukraine and Belarus. Over and over again, we find these problems. And people were questioning it, but it, you know, it's very difficult if you're a non-scientist, if you're, you know, a political activist. The physicists pop up and they're like, you don't know what you're talking about. They say that even to doctors. They say that to me. There's a nuclear engineering department at MIT where I teach, and they don't like me at all. And they often say things like, you have no right to speak. You're not a specialist. We're the only ones who can make pronouncements about nuclear issues. But I might add that the nuclear engineering department at MIT gets funding from French nuclear power companies, from Japanese nuclear power companies, from American nuclear power companies. So they're not, they themselves, those scholars, are not necessarily disinterested parties in this discussion. Olya and I did not take any money from any anti-nuclear agencies.
Yeah, and I, Timothy said that the nuclear accidents alarmed Ukrainian society and steered the democratic movement. Well, this was, of course, true for the late 80s, but I would not overestimate the significance of this movement, because Ukraine still remains a very pro-nuclear country, and the Chernobyl accident is taken rather as a big exception and not as something that should guide our society in its development. I've talked to many Ukrainians who consider nuclear energy safe, and many claim, for example, that in the nuclear power plant in Zaporizhia emitted so much less harmful substances than other plants in Zaporizhia. I have also good contacts in the research institute in Kiev, and I can see that the safety nowadays is absolutely different and a lot better than the safety in the 1980s. And I can see that these are responsible, sober-minded people working there. But we should, when we talk about safety, we should consider multiple threats, and some threats we can hardly foresee. People who talked about Zaporizhia hardly ever imagined that there would be just simply Russian soldiers with missiles, with bombs, who just come and take over. And like, this case obviously shows us that our idea of nuclear safety were partial, were not really, did not really include the full scale risk analysis. And it's the research nuclear facility in Kharkiv is very much threatened. So many risks were not taken into account, and the cyber attacks and the software used in the nuclear facilities is probably not all safe, because it was designed in Russia. The software I saw in the Institute of Nuclear Research in Kyiv was designed in Russia, and Russia is still in control of many parts in the nuclear cycle, because nuclear energy is not just producing nuclear energy in a container. It's a big industry, and I think that Ukraine should definitely rethink its understanding of nuclear safety, and we should never say that Chernobyl accident taught Ukrainian society something. There is a viable plan of installing a new reactor in Khmelnytsky power plant. It was an idea of a former president, Petro Poroshenko. The current president did not dismiss that idea. And we can see that there are plans for nuclear future, which seemingly helps the Ukrainian society to build its energy sovereignty, independence. It's of course a very, very controversial topic, but whatever the future is, whatever our discussion is, there are good grounds to rethink the ideas of safety.
Yeah, in fact, with a climate scientist here at MIT, we reran the numbers, and I'll put this in the chat, this article we wrote, that if Ukraine were to replace, used its combined wind and solar potential, it would replace by 150% the nuclear power that's being deployed right now in Ukraine. So it would be, I mean, imagine in rebuilding, if there was decentralized sources of power, solar panels on roofs and wind factories, and the Russians couldn't just come in and flip a switch and capture a plant, capture a flag, and control energy sources for entire cities where millions of people live, that these could be localized sources of power. Decentralized power helps to decentralize political power and economic wealth in societies. It's a wonderful thing not to have to rely on either another nation, such as Russia, or another a big power company for your power. It's great if you can have panels on top of your roof and generate your own power and feel a certain household autarky. It's a wonderful thing to look forward to in rebuilding.
Yeah, absolutely. But those things that you were talking so far, they, as I noticed, they often focus on sort of monetary financial incentives. You know, we were talking about big organizations, we were talking about a huge part of economies, and we even discussed the issue that maybe scientists, they can benefit from working for these organizations. Yeah, so it seems like economy and incentives is a very big part of your book and of the story. But also, I'd like to talk about something else, which is also about security, but more from military perspective. So yeah, Ukraine is also known as one of the countries that signed this Budapest memorandum, promising, you know, to basically drop the status of a nuclear state. This memorandum did not work. Now we enter the new era when the Russian propaganda machine tried to sell these stories that Ukraine is kind of preparing secretly nuclear weapon and they should be stopped before it happens. So it seems that right now the subject of nuclear security is also weaponized again and again. Do you have anything about this in your book? How did international actors and local actors perceive nuclear power from the perspective of military? Maybe they had some incentives to preserve it, you know, to build rockets, or I don't know. Did it change over time? Maybe how we perceive nuclear threats in the 80s is very different from how we perceive them today. Can you reflect on all that?
Yeah, you know, the RBMK reactor, which was the Chernobyl style reactor, the Soviets only built those inside the Soviet Union. When they exported reactors, they exported VVER reactors. And the reason why is that RBMK reactors were what was known as a dual purpose reactor. It could produce electricity in great volume, great wattage, and it could also produce plutonium, which is the core of nuclear bombs. And so that the Soviets wanted, they were worried in the early 1980s because Ronald Reagan was amping up the arms race with his Star Wars program. And so that was going to mean it's kind of amazing to think about, but yet more missiles were going to be needed if they were going to answer step for step. And the people, not necessarily Gorbachev, but the people in the nuclear arms ministry, the secret ministry, Minsred Mash, they wanted to answer the Americans missile for missile. And so those RBMK reactors, they were holding in reserve because they thought we could use those to produce more plutonium for the send to the bomb cores. So that's something to think about. Like, we would not have nuclear power. Nuclear power would not make sense economically if it hadn't been for nuclear weapons. There would have been nobody who would have invested in the design of them. There would have been no big governments to indemnify them in case of accidents in the United States. The taxpayers, if a private company has a reactor that blows up, the taxpayers will pay for the cleanup, not the company. We see that same problem, same phenomenon in most countries. So the reason why nuclear power is attractive is because it holds behind it the possibility to make nuclear weapons. And so when we see Saudi Arabia today seeking to become a civilian nuclear power, that's kind of funny because in Saudi Arabia, there's a lot of oil and there's a lot of solar and wind potential. But the assumption is they want to be, they want to have nuclear weapons as well. And we see, you know, the Russians are sort of basically turning the Chernobyl zone and the Zaporizhzhia plant, and they were heading for the southern nuclear power plant. Also, they were making a beeline to go take that because those can be weaponized as dirty bombs. There's so much spent radioactive fuel there that, you know, Chernobyl only ran for 3 years before it blew up. That meant that's good news that there was not that much dirty spent fuel, but the longer that the fuel is irradiated, the more radioactive it is. So the Zaporizhzhia plant, if those spent fuel basins were to blow, it would become the world's biggest nuclear accident yet again.
Yeah, well, we don't want this to happen, of course. That's fascinating. And also I was, you know, when I was preparing for this conversation, I did have, you know, some questions in my mind. So half of my questions are improvised, but now I want to ask those questions that I actually prepared. I am quite interested in, as a sociologist, I'm quite interested in civil society and civil society organizations and their role in, you know, in shaping political agenda and changing the political discourses and situations in the country. I don't know if you heard of this story, but there was a quite famous sociologist. She's perceived as a sort of a role model for many Ukrainian sociologists. Her name is Natalia Panina. And during the late 80s, apparently as an activist, she tried to debunk some of the myths and narratives published in Soviet press. And surprisingly, one of these myths was that apparently people, they have sort of an anxiety or stress towards nuclear power. And they try to sell this story, sort of this is a real psychological, sort of psychologically backed up theory that indeed people do have this kind of anxiety, specific psychological response to nuclear threats. And they tried to explain that everything what was happening with, you know, with civil society, with these rumors that people were talking about nuclear threats and they were disappointed with government, they tried to play it down by saying that this is just an anxiety. And this person, Natalia Panina, because she was a sociologist and psychologist, she knew that it was nonsense. And she published quite a lot of papers about that. And then it became her, you know, sort of a badge of honor that she did that, and it became a part of her CV and reputation. And there are so many, you know, stories like that in Ukraine, and I'm sure in Belarus. And I was wondering, did you encounter any other similar stories, you know, about people, you know, regular people, journalists or scholars or civil society members who try to address this issue, who try to maybe change the agenda and influence these big corporations and the international agencies, like yourself? You talk to many scholars who try to dismiss, you know, your ideas. Maybe you encountered some other people who did that.
Yeah, do you want to answer that? Oh yeah, I feel like I'm talking a lot.
Yeah, we're here to talk. there were many activists in Ukraine, and I think that this many people understood that radiophobia is a fake meme in the public sphere. Many people debunked these memes in any way possible. I met wonderful people. Some of them were members of the organization Zeleny Svit in the late 80s. Some were members of Ukrainsky kulturologichny klub, Ukrainian Culture Club. Some were straight activists, Natalia Baranowska, historian, and
Natalia Lozicka.
Natalia Lozicka also, she also lives in Obolon. She was just conducting experiments at home, reading journals, and there were many people. But the question in late 80s was, do they dare to speak up, and do they have a lot of voice in the media? Natalia Lozicka wrote a letter to Gorbachev that he never responded and never took action. Ukrainian Cultural Club members convened at Maidan Nezalezhnosti Central Square in 1987 and then 1988 on the 26th of April. They suffered police attacks. They spent some time in the police department. There were also other stories of people for whom speaking up was meant some threat to their lives and the lives of their families and their careers. And we can speak of many people who did sacrifice something in late 80s to speak up. And not all stories are success stories. Some people lost something indeed and did suffer from trying to speak up. Some people spoke up, but that did not bring to anything immediately. Did not bring to the results. And we see that just being objective and expressing one's view is a lot, and it's really good that some people managed to deliver their messages. Not all were like Natalia Panina, not all succeeded in speaking. And back then, a lot of information was just spread by mouth. People in 86, they talked to their neighbors and relatives, and over the phone, sometimes the connection would get lost. But this was an act of courage back then.
Yeah, I mean, we called them everyday heroes, and they showed up in the archives over and over and over again. People who, you know, a doctor who said, you know, there's absolutely no way you can have radioactive waste running into the Zhytomyr drinking reservoir. He was the sanitation doctor for the town. He was fired for doing that, but he wasn't fired, he was demoted, but he stuck to his guns. There was a radiation monitor in Ukraine who, they would have these dueling Geiger counters. The Russian officials would come in and say, no, it's much lower. And this one guy kept saying, no, it's really high. And his numbers bear out, we find in time. Natalia Lazitska was so intent on getting, she was a physicist, and she had measured and realized that the levels of radioactivity were dangerously high during the accident in Kiev and in towns in northern Ukraine. And she brought her file of information to this conference of international scientists in 1988 that the Soviet government hosted in Kiev. And she went into the theater dressed as a cleaning lady with a bucket and a mop. That's how she snuck in. And then she grabs Robert Gale, this American doctor who became sort of the face, the Western face of Chernobyl. And she tries to give him her papers. Knowing Gale's politics, he wouldn't have done anything with them. He would have thrown them out. But she was swooped up before she was able to deliver the papers by the KGB agents, who then tossed her out the back alley with her bucket and her mop.
Wow. This is a fascinating story. And I assume that all these stories are in your book. Is this correct? So maybe since we're almost out of time, you can plug in and, you know, say something about your book. How is it called in Ukrainian language? Where can we buy it? Olga, maybe you can say just a few words to promote it.
Well, the Ukrainian translation is long finished, but with the coronavirus and now with the war, the publication is obviously postponed. I hope that it's in print soon, and I hope that we will not have another nuclear accident to make this book sell more than.
Yeah, we don't need to write another introduction or something like this. Yeah.
The title. What will the title be in Ukrainian?
Інструкція з виживання, екологічна історія Чорнобильської катастрофи.
And I'm trying to get the press to put out an ebook in the near future, since it's going to be hard to get a print book out.
Yeah, but the book is available in many other languages, and many Ukrainians read English. I worked hard to translate all Kate's wonderful metaphors into Ukrainian, but I think that you can also, like those who can read and enjoy English, they will find the book fascinating, and not all should wait until Ukrainian translation. The book is already available in English.
And in Polish and Slovak and Lithuanian, other languages too, that might be comprehensible to some people.
Yeah, so yeah, thank you very much. And Olga, I apologize. I didn't want to put any pressure, of course, you know. Whenever it appears, I'm sure we will be happy to read it in Ukrainian language. So far, our audience will enjoy reading it in English, absolutely. Well, it was a huge pleasure for me to talk to you. This has been a fascinating conversation. I learned a lot. I want to read your book right now. I already, you know, Googled it, and I know how to purchase it. So I will start reading tonight. Thank you very much for spending this 50 minutes with us. I'm very honored. It is very important for us to talk to colleagues during this terrible invasion. And what can I say? I hope we will meet in the peaceful Kiev, and we will talk about your book. Oh, no, Bologna. specifically.
Yes, let's have a good presentation at Obolon and Kate with us.
Perfect. This is, my dreams come true. We talk about Obolon. Yes. Okay. Thank you very much. Take care and enjoy your day.
Thank you. Bye-bye, Timofey and Orya. Bye-bye.
Bye.